I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Most middle-aged adults experienced a childhood vastly different from children growing up today. Not only has technology changed the childhood experience, concerns over safety prevent many parents from allowing their children to play unsupervised, and the proliferation of litigation has homogenized playgrounds. But are our children today safer? Have new playgrounds reduced injuries? And more importantly, what are the developmental implications of removing all risk from childhood experiences? Joining us to discuss the value of risk in children's play and the evolution of playgrounds, Susan Solomon, architectural historian who's written a number of books about playgrounds, joins us on the phone. Good morning, Susan. Susan, are you there? Okay. And our second guest is Joan Allman, founding director of the Alliance for Childhood and former co-chair of the Waldorf Early Childhood Association of North America. Joan, good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Do we have Susan as well? Susan, are you there?
I am.
Okay, great.
You can hear me.
I can hear you. Great. We've got you both.
Good morning, Mindy.
Good morning.
Good morning, Joan. Good morning, Susan.
So before we even begin discussing risk-taking in play, let's talk about the importance of play itself. It seems that children in the U.S. have fewer opportunities for free play than previous generations. They're distracted with electronic media, organized sports, helicopter parents. So why is free play important developmentally? And Joan, let's start with you.
Okay, well, you know, when you think about how we human beings are made up, we have a physical nature, we have a social-emotional nature, we have a cognitive nature. You know, we have active minds, hearts, and bodies, one could say. And all of those are stimulated through play. Play is one of those activities that touches every part of us as a human being. And if you watch children at play, you can see it happening. They're physically very active. They're very often engaged with other children. They're socially negotiating. They're creating together. And they're trying out new ideas. They're always expanding their minds through play, testing things. They're like little scientists in a lab. Well, what if we put it together this way? Oh, no, that didn't work. Well, let's try it this way. You know, so play is just massive stimulation for children's development and very much of an integrator of those different realms, because those realms don't live separately in us, and they need to be integrated, and play does that for children.
Susan, do you want to add anything to that?
I think what is said is that we have such an over attention to presumably academics and testing, and I think this is one of the reasons that play is so devalued, that we're often seeing recess cut down in schools, and so that adds to the problem.
Right. I don't think many of us stop to consider the history or evolution of playgrounds, but Susan, you've studied and written about this topic. Playgrounds become a reflection of where we are as a society. So tell us about the emergence of playgrounds.
Sure. It's a relatively recent idea. It really goes back to the late 19th, early 20th century. It's very much an urban form. And the first playgrounds were really created because of the tremendous amount of immigration in the early part of the 20th century. And so they existed to keep kids off the street, keep them safe, but also to acclimate them to American culture. And so they really were a social agency. And the social agency extended to even include libraries and health centers. We wouldn't recognize it as today's playground. The area that comes closest to what we think of as playgrounds were what they called the apparatus, which were these really sort of horrifyingly high, very tottering pieces of equipment that people could climb all over. There were enormous ladders at very unusual angles, and everybody was expected to use this. In fact, they were open at night, so adults would be sure to come. The idea of a dedicated space for kids only in public space really comes about later, at the end of the so-called progressive reform movement. So the late 1920s, 1930s, and that's when you have the individual slide, seesaw, sandbox in public space. And then there's a major shift after World War II, and there are two things that I think happen. One is you get a lot of the same pieces of equipment, but they're now sort of gussied up with whimsical characters and things that relate to things happening, spaceships and the Wizard of Oz and different animals. But the parallel development is that you have architects and landscape architects beginning to think about how can play be linked together. And so they're coming up with ways in which it's not separate individual pieces, but things that combine. And they are not just combined horizontally, but they're combined vertically. And they're really amazing site installations. And the sad thing is that kind of development becomes watered down as we go on, and that's really the beginning of what we now see as what I call side-of-the-road equipment, the ubiquitous, you go up, you go across, you go down. And so it's been very much diminished and commercialized.
As Americans become more risk adverse, we see a standardization of playground equipment, which, you know, even signs telling us the age group that it's designed for.
So
playgrounds are now designed by engineers and technical experts instead of people who know something about children's play and development. Is that right?
I don't know if I would say that. I think these people know about play. They know about children, but they also feel that the product they need to sell has to be, because of demand, as safe as possible, as maintenance-free as possible. And so they're really I don't think they're ignorant at all. I think they're just responding to the marketplace.
Mm. Joan, what do you think?
Well, I would agree with that, and I know a number of manufacturers of playground equipment because they're involved with the U.S. Play Coalition, which I'm also part of. And they really study play. They know a lot about play. They're very committed to play. And I would say they themselves, the manufacturers that I've met, are highly playful and adventuresome. But they can't go as far as they would like to go in the design of equipment. We've had some great conversations about adventure playgrounds and more adventurous equipment. And if there was a demand for it, if the parks departments would say, okay, we're going to bite the bullet. We're going to start giving children opportunities for more risk because we trust them to risk assess, then I think the manufacturers would get on board in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
I think a lot of them would really like to expand their offerings that way.
What's surprising is that despite our focus on making playgrounds safer, we're not seeing a significant decline in playground-related injuries. According to the National Electronic Injury Surveillance System, which monitors hospital visits, the frequency of emergency room visits related to playground equipment, including home equipment, in 1980 was one visit per 1,452 Americans. In 2012, it was one per 1,156 Americans. So it's surprising. Is it surprising to you that despite our focus on making playgrounds safer, injury rates have not declined, or not much anyway?
I think there's something inherently misleading about some of these facts, which are true. But the flip side is you're very rarely, in fact, you really sort of have to dig very deeply to find out how many of these injuries are severe. And it's something like less than 6% result in hospital admission. So I think what we're seeing is that these are relatively minor, maybe a stitch or two, maybe perhaps, you know, as bad as a broken limb, but that these are not necessarily severe injuries. And I don't want to sound callous. It's painful to ever see a child hurt. But, you know, there's risk in the world. Mm-hmm. And if we are going to try to get rid of all injuries, this is a problem. And so I think we have to look at how severe are these injuries. And I think, fortunately, they are not. There's a belief, and there are people in the UK writing about this, that in fact this cushy surfacing that we've been relying on for a few decades may actually be causing greater number of upper limb breaks. Mm-hmm. So there's a constant trade-off.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned cushy surfacing. Most of the playgrounds we see now, they have either that kind of rubber, matting stuff,
yep,
or wood chips. And
yeah,
and my daughter, actually, just walking across some of those wood chips at one of the school playgrounds here, a piece went through the bottom of her shoe and cut her foot.
Well, you know, it's really interesting when we compare what happens here to what happens in Europe. There, the standard is very much to use sand. Now, sand requires a little more maintenance, and there are actually people in this country who've done research who say not all sand is alike, that there are different varieties. But if you choose a particular kind, you actually create a much safer surface than the wood chips or the spongy stuff.
Right.
And that, in fact, then we're creating a better environment because you have something kids can manipulate and play with.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot to be thought about as far as how safe are these presumably safe things.
Now, some have suggested that because playgrounds are so safe, children aren't as careful, which could lead them to get hurt in ways playground designers haven't considered. Do you think children seek out more dangerous play or activities to compensate for the lack of risk or challenge in standardized playgrounds?
Absolutely. No question about it. Just look at the way they do crazy things because they're bored. So you find kids, you know, standing on the top of the equipment and jumping off and things that the equipment was really never intended for. But they're looking for some kind of thrill, and they're going to find it.
Well, coming up after the break, we visit the Land Adventure Playground in the UK that allows children the kind of play we remember most fondly from our own childhood. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing the importance of risk-taking in children's play. So-called adventure playgrounds have quietly flourished in the UK since the end of the Second World War. They take many forms, from chaotic junkyards to whimsical shantytowns, yet each embrace a fundamental belief in the necessary and positive relationship between risk and play. Death traps, by any American standard, they allow children the kind of play we remember most fondly from our own childhoods. Producer Aaron Davis visited one such playground in the UK about an hour's drive from Liverpool.
I love it when new kids come to the playground because
Whoa. It
is out of the ordinary.
Wow, I love this place.
This is Paige. She's 9 years old.
This is my first time being here.
Is it?
Yeah, my first time.
She's at a playground in North Wales about an hour's drive from Liverpool. It's called The Land.
Oh, look, a cave. We can probably go in there. It's very small, but I think it won't stop us. Echo!
But this is an adventure playground. Instead of slides and swings,
Whoa. It
has hammer and nails, old tires, a fire pit, and a piano, bloated and out of tune from sitting in the rain.
Come on, you haven't done. This way.
Steep, muddy hills are covered with bikes and buckets, broken toys and rope. It's a junkyard. It's fair to say that by any American standard, it's a death trap.
We've had 40 years of people with clipboards telling us that this is all unsafe, like we didn't know that.
Arthur Batram writes about playgrounds in the UK. He says the reason for having loose stuff everywhere...
It's a very, very simple idea. Permission. If you fill up a space with junk that is so obviously junk, you're giving children permission to do whatever they like with the stuff.
At The Land, children have everything they need to do anything they want. It's all provided by adults called play workers. But an adult who gives a child hammer, nails, and their blessing is not as pathological as you might think.
A play worker is very reflective.
This is Claire. She's in charge here.
And we watch the children that we work with and see what interests them. For example, we've got one little girl and she likes to sit and be on her own. As a play worker, you identify that and then you provide. We had the sofa just opposite us and she'd just lie there for the whole session. You know, you don't have to go up to her and say, you're all right, you're quiet and you're on your own. No, it's fine. If you want to be quiet here, that's fine. If you want to be noisy and loud, that's fine. We don't put our agenda onto that child. The child is the starting point.
But there is a saying in the world of adventure playgrounds. better a broken bone than a broken spirit.
And I think that's true. Children have to learn how to manage their own risks. And, you know, it's hard. It's hard as a parent to allow your child to do that. But you've just got to.
It is very bumpy here. And it's very slippy. But it gets muddier and slippier and mostly dangerous.
Safety is something which I take seriously. For us, safety involves removing any hazards. It doesn't involve removing risks.
Claire is a play worker, and play workers believe that a risk is something a child chooses to do, like climbing a tree or watching a match burn down closer and closer to your fingertips. A hazard is something a child can't see that can cause them harm, like broken glass or rusty nails lying around. In an adventure playground, play workers remove the hazards and let the kids take the risks. Something that's risky for one child may not be for another.
Hey, let's go to the swing! Go to the swing!
Like yesterday on the rope swing, she scraped her knee and there was nothing there and she was squeezing it to try and get some blood out. She just wanted reassurance, she wanted comfort and that it's okay. Your leg doesn't need sawing off, you're going to be fine.
Now, we made it. That's a lucky thing because we could have died. Yeah.
Walking from one side of the playground to the other could take a child about 30 seconds. That's if they didn't stop along the way, which, of course, they do. They come through the gate and up the main path and look around, surveying the land, assessing their options.
Look, see that one? They made a fire in there, but they didn't even let me have a peep.
Paige points to a little fort with smoke coming from the windows. Some boys she knows have a fire going inside.
Why are you not even letting me in?
Hey, no!
Why?
Paige, you're not coming in!
I'm not in.
I don't care!
She's shut out, in a classic case of no girls allowed.
They never let me see things. And I don't know why.
It's important for adults to know that not everything they see is going to make them feel happy and comfortable, even though it's called a playground.
This is Dave. He's a play worker here. And a large part of play work involves delicate improvising. So when three boys start this fire, Dave climbs in behind them with two buckets of water, wedges himself into a corner, and sits quietly. The boys crouch around a small flame.
And they start putting bits on.
Paper! Give me paper! I need paper! I want to put this on!
Smoking!
I'm a pirate!
Dead funny.
The boys are all between 9 and 11. The space, not much bigger than if you were hiding under the dining room table.
This is going to go on fire any few seconds right now.
And play. They play with the edges of their lives, you know, which is where things like swearing come into it.
These kids have been coming to the playground for a long time. They've had a lot of fires, and Dave knows them well.
So I knew at some point it was going to get bigger.
I want to put this on.
It got smoky, you know, their eyes would be watering from the smoke. Even though I'm not completely overwhelmed by the smoke, I sort of move away to make it look like I want to get a bit of air.
So you were faking it?
A little bit, yeah.
So Dave climbs out of the fort to sort of indicate to the boys that it's smoky, it's hot, it might be time to go. But the boys don't take the hint. They stay inside the fort with a pile of cardboard and an idea.
Wait, I think we put it all on. We may as well. This will make all the difference. Yeah, we're fine.
You okay?
Uh-oh.
Dave ducks back in and surveys the scene. There's smoke and a fire about the size of a volleyball. The boys have all backed away a bit. Until one kid puts a cardboard box over the fire, like a lid.
Leave it! Leave it! No. Leave it! Look!
If you've ever played with fire, you know what happens next. The heat gets trapped, and the box goes up. Two boys climb out.
The two left.
And one stays.
I let him still in there in the corner, and the smoke was blowing towards him. Right now?
Yeah.
Rather than going, get out the smoke, get out the den, I just said, you know, little things like the smoke's all coming to you late.
It's all coming your way late.
And then he left as well. And they all left.
Children built the fire. They felt slightly a little bit out of control of the fire.
They left the fire
and then they put it out.
Put out the fire now!
Excuse me!
You put out the fire!
Excuse me.
With very little adult intervention. I think it's important that play workers are there because not all children are as good as that at managing their own risk.
I was there and at no point did I think they were in any serious danger. The fire didn't lick the roof, it wasn't catching other stuff. And I have put fires out in there before. But at that point with those boys, I didn't feel the need, I knew.
It's so important for play workers. Even when you feel uncomfortable with what's going on, that's not what should inform your next move. The development of the children in front of you is what should inform your next move. And
for them to experience what it's like to have a fire in a confined space and want to move away from it is a powerful thing for a child. Leighton even said at one point, it's the smoke that kills you, it's not the fire. So that's quite a powerful thing for them to experience. And hey presto, they left it.
No, being here is a lot more fun. Yeah, is this almost open every week?
Most time, yeah.
My mum said if it's open every week or something, I can probably go every day if it's open.
We're open for another hour as well.
Yeah. Now we can go back onto our journey. But we have a bit of trouble on the way. We're trying very hard to get back home. And we made it. We made it.
The Land Adventure Playground is featured in a new documentary film. We'll have a link at our website, capeandislands.org. This piece was originally aired on transom.org and was produced with help from Vicki Merrick. We are talking with Susan Solomon, architectural historian who's written a number of books about playgrounds, and Joan Allman, founding director of the Alliance for Childhood and former co-chair of the Waldorf Early Childhood Association of North America. All right, playing with fire, it's hard to believe adults would allow this to happen, but when we think back to our own childhoods, I bet many of us did play with fire. I know I was listening to this piece, and there's a great piece in The Atlantic, The Overprotected Kid, and I'm reading this going, what fire? And then I went, wait a second, all these things that I'm sort of going, never, I actually did in my own childhood.
Yes, can I add something to that?
Yes.
I often have a chance to meet with staff from parks departments, and one of the things I like to do is to collect play memories from people, but even if we don't have much time, I'll say, well, you know, how many of you played this or how many of you played that? And when I ask them how many of you played with fire as children, at least half their hands go up.
Right.
You know, these were youngsters who were really comfortable with outdoor play, and now they're comfortable in parks settings, but at least half of them played with fire as children.
Yeah.
I didn't happen to play with fire as a child. I wish I had.
I did.
But I had the Girl Scout approach to fire.
There you go, right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. We'd love to hear from you. Did you go outside and play unsupervised when you were a kid? And do you let your children do that? How much freedom did you have? And do you think your children are too sheltered today? 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Was it Joan or Susan? Go ahead.
It's such a great piece that Erin Davis has put together. And I think one of the things that comes through is that kids are given all this freedom, but that there's somebody watching just to be sure. So it's very comforting to parents who feel their child should not be alone. And it seems that, you know, if we're going to have a, if society has evolved to the point where parents feel that they want to constantly know or hover over their children, this is such a better solution.
Yeah. The adventure play.
I had the chance to visit the land last fall, and
how lucky.
Yes, it's everything that Aaron has said about it, and also Hannah Rosen in the Atlantic article. It's just a wonderful place for children. It's a very messy, junky place. So there's a part of me that's always wanting to tidy up a little bit, but I don't do that in a play situation because, as somebody, I think it was Arthur Batrum in that audio piece, said, children look at this and it gives them permission to play. And I think that's incredibly important. And when I was at the land, I would watch the children enter, as I've watched at other adventure playgrounds I've visited. You know, and you can just see them sort of light up because they see all this junk around, and they know that adults aren't going to get upset with them if something breaks. They're not destructive with it, but things break. But this is not precious material. These are there for the children to play with. And so they have an incredible sense of being allowed to explore and develop and just try things out that work for them.
Yeah. Susan, walk us through the history of adventure playgrounds. They have roots in Europe, but they haven't taken hold in the U.S.
No, not at all. At most, I think in the 1970s, there were about 12 in America, and now there's one remaining full-time adventure playground in Berkeley, California, and it's pretty wondrous. The idea came about in Denmark in the late 30s. There was a landscape architect who thought about how children played and manipulated things, but he didn't actually get to activate this idea until the middle of the war, 1942 or 1943. So Denmark was under German occupation, and you can't even, I mean, it still amazes me to think about what did they have to throw out. But apparently they had some scraps and things, and he collected these in this one housing, workers' housing cooperative, put them in the center courtyard, sort of cordoned it off for kids, and assigned one person to sort of just watch over and make sure things didn't get out of control. And then after the war, these were very prevalent in Scandinavia and in the U.K. In the U.K., largely because of a woman whose name was Lady Allen of Hertwood. She's the woman who actually, I believe, was the first to say, as you heard in the piece on the land, better a broken limb than a broken spirit. And she was sort of inspired both by what was happening in Scandinavia, and also seeing how kids in London were playing with rubble after the Blitz. And so she became a huge proponent of having adventure playgrounds in the United Kingdom. And what's fascinating is that, as we know, they exist there today, but there's also a flourishing on the continent, particularly in the Netherlands and Germany, and there's a very active group of adventure playgrounds in Japan.
Hmm, interesting. Let's talk to Joel, who's giving us a call from Brewster. Hi, Joel.
Hi. What a great program. you know, a beach used to be a tremendous playground, and especially where there was some creek in it or a salt marsh, because there was always an old boat that's been laying there for years because it's kind of falling apart. Nobody's used it. It'd be an old dory, somebody's old catboat or something or other. Now you go down there and the place is swept clean. If somebody brings in a boat there with one plank loose, the town drags it off to the dump. Kids used to just love to play in those things and make believe that, you know, they
you're a pirate or something, right?
You find little kids playing in a boat in the water, and people get all uptight and especially go out and take a boat out. In Brewster, you cannot get in trouble. The tide goes out a mile and a half, and the kids all knew back when there were knowledgeable people around here that if they swamped the boat or anything like that, all they had to do was stay with it, throw an anchor out, and they've got a mile and a half out and 15 miles east to west, where in 3 hours they could get out and walk ashore,
walk ashore
and drag the boat with them in knee-deep water. Nobody knows anything about that sort of thing. In the old days, instead of a playground, the guys would be in the woods.
Yeah, you'd make your own playground. Joel, thanks for that. We also have an email from Mark from Brewster. Says, I'm listening to the story about the UK playground, and I am absolutely amazed. This is what we need. As kids, three boys, all 2 years apart, we used to do all these same type of things around our house. I grew up in western Pennsylvania on 15 acres in a rural area, and we did some crazy stuff. Yes, we got hurt, but never bad enough to require a trip to the doctor. I miss that play and wish my girls could go back there with me. It's sad how we've sterilized play. Don't get me started on the BB gun wars in the woods with my cousins. Admittedly, that was dumb. And yes, we played with fire and firecrackers. Mark, thanks for that email. Joan, research has shown us that children have an innate ability to risk assess. Tell us about the study of 6-month-old babies who were demonstrating risk assessment.
Yeah, isn't that a lovely study?
That's amazing.
Yeah. So the study was originally designed to see if 6-month-olds had depth perception. And these children who could now crawl were put on a big piece of plexiglass, and under the plexiglass there was a board painted like a checkerboard. And about halfway down the plexiglass, the checkerboard dropped about 18 inches and then continued, but the plexiglass stayed at the same level. So they wanted to see, did the babies observe this drop? And all of them did. And what happened, though, is they'd get to the drop, and some would back off, and some would sort of test the plexiglass to see if it continued, and then they would go forward. And so people realized that not only could they see the drop, but they could risk assess whether it was safe to continue across that drop. And we see this in children all the time. I taught 3 to 6-year-olds for almost 20 years. They risk assess constantly. I had one 5-year-old girl who could climb high up into a pine tree without ever getting injured. But I had nobody else in that class that wanted to do that. They didn't think they were able, probably, or they weren't interested. Children will... Risk assessment means I know what I'm capable of doing, and I can see what the environment is calling for. And we do it all the time when we cross a busy road without a traffic light, right? We risk assess, you know, okay, there's a gap in the cars. I think I can make it across all right. I live in a college town, so the 19-year-olds, they'll go into much smaller gaps than I will because they're faster than I am. We risk assess all the time, but children are growing up not knowing how to risk assess.
Yeah.
And that, to my mind, is the biggest risk of all.
We are talking about the value of risk in children's play and the evolution of playgrounds. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeendislands.org. We have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the value of risk in children's play with Joan Allman, founding director of the Alliance for Childhood and former co-chair of the Waldorf Early Childhood Association of North America, and Susan Solomon, architectural historian who's written a number of books about playgrounds. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Would you let your child play in the adventure playground, such as the land, as that piece we heard? Our email address, thepoint@capeendislands.org. Is there evidence that risk assessment develops through use?
Certainly observational evidence. I don't actually know of a study that was done about that. But, what you see is a typically developing child who's given a chance to play out in nature, let's say. You just see this developing. You know, can I leap out to that rock in the middle of the creek? Well, not as a 4-year-old, but now as a 6-year-old I can. You know, this is an example out of my own classroom experience that working with mixed age groups, I watch children over a 3-year period take on more and more risk, going to the same play areas again and again, but using them differently depending on their age and what they could do in those areas. And we had very natural-based playgrounds with some hand-built equipment, but not a lot of equipment. Just a lot of natural challenges for children.
Mm.
But so, yes, I think that it does develop over time. Their actual abilities and their risk assessment abilities get more sophisticated as they grow older. They can take on more complex issues. in risk assessment. That's what one wants for children, is that they have a chance to develop those things.
We sometimes use the term fearless to describe a particular child. In your experience, are there kids that can't or don't evaluate risk?
Yes, there are. And I didn't take this as seriously as I think I should have when I was teaching. I only worked with one child that I felt fell in that category, but I've since then known of others who then in their 20s really had a hard time in life. They had a hard time just sort of finding their way. And in the case of one boy whom I knew because he was a neighbor of a good friend, he was always getting himself into trouble as a child and going to the emergency room. And now as a young adult, you know, he's kind of been in and out of jail and he's in and out of different problematic situations. So when there's a youngster who doesn't develop a good sense of risk assessment and is foolhardy, one could say, I would look seriously at that. You know, what's happening with that child? How could we strengthen, you know, their sense of balance, their sense of coordination, just working at it at a physical level, not even at a psychological level, but what could we do to strengthen that child so that they become better at knowing their own body and looking at the world and knowing how to use their body appropriately in the world and not becoming the child who's in an emergency room off and on again and again.
Right. Marsha's giving us a call from Truro. Hi, Marsha.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Great. My husband and I had just returned from the Netherlands and saw three adventure playgrounds, and I was caught by two things. I saw two little girls, probably about 4 and 5, with Mary Janes and little skirts on, scrambling up this big rope monstrosity, and a third child that was not with them watched the two girls, and then she slowly climbed up and watched the two get higher and higher. She was deciding how far she could go, which we thought was fascinating. The other thing I saw was that the children over there, and I don't know if this has anything to do with the other thing, but they all seem to be much less crybaby, less fussy with their parents, less demanding, because it seemed like they were taking more risks in the playgrounds. So they seem more self-assured and more family-oriented. I don't know if that has to do with one thing or another.
Yeah, Marsha, thanks for sharing that. Thoughts, ladies?
I think there's a greater sense of responsibility in Europe. And I wonder if this might be what Marsha is seeing, and that there's a sense that I am responsible for myself. There are a lot of factors that result in our litigiousness, but there's a basic belief, I think, in America that somebody is at fault. And that's one of the reasons there are so many lawsuits is, somebody else is to blame. Whereas I feel in Europe it's much, and I've actually heard play workers say that when there's an accident, they work with the child. Well, what went wrong here? And how can we fix this in the future? And I think that there is this sense that of looking within one's own actions to see why did this happen? And so I think it works in both a self-assessment in terms of what went wrong and a self-assessment as to what can go right. Mm.
You know, it's that article we've been talking about in The Atlantic, The Overprotected Kid. Hannah Rosen brings her son with her.
Yeah.
And there's a section where she talks about he doesn't like water. He doesn't like a drop of water falls on him when he's brushing his teeth. He freaks out. And in that play situation, another kid is pushing him. I think it was in a box or something. And you can see they're going down to a creek. And they talk about this. Well, you might get wet. And indeed, he does get wet, gets up and goes and continues to play. Something he wouldn't have done at home.
Right. There's social pressure, too, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that the ability to do things that feel a little bit dangerous is part of the appeal of the adventure playground as well.
So
not real danger, but...
Right. Well, that's what I was going to say, this perception of risk versus actual risk. Could we design activities and structures that make kids think they're taking risks, but in actuality are relatively safe? Like we heard that in that piece where the girl said, we could have died.
Yeah.
Not really. But that she thought so.
Well, when we have a little report called Adventure, The Value of Risk in Children's Play, and we differentiate three levels of risk. And one of them are the things that look dangerous, but in fact there's a lot of safety nets built in. So, you know, on an adult level, you could think of bungee jumping, which looks absolutely deadly, except if the firm knows what it's doing, you're not going to get hurt doing it. But, you know, if you're crossing a log over a creek, you could fall, and if it's a big fall, you could get hurt. There's not a safety net for you. That's the kind of risk I think we're actually talking about, is where something could happen, but if it does, it's not, most likely it's not going to be deadly. This is not at that level. That's the third level, where you know, you watch these youngsters in the Olympics and you think, oh my gosh, you know, when they're flipping in the air, their snowboards and so on, you know, a bad accident could be deadly, but they've trained and trained for it, and that's what happens with high-level risk, is that you do a lot of training to get yourself ready to handle that. But I think what we're really talking about here is that second level, where children know they could be hurt, but the adults have, you know, kind of risk-assessed the situation enough that they're not going to let something terrible happen to the children. And when we were off on our own, which I was as a child, we had to be more active in risk assessment because there weren't adults around to kind of be there with the barrel, the bucket of water, and so on. So, you know, if children built a fire, they had to pay a little attention to how all of that was going to go. Nowadays, parents don't let any of that happen, and then this is one reason we favor adventure playgrounds and play workers, because it does give a chance for children to go out and have adventurous play and face risk and develop the ability to risk assess within the boundaries that adults need today, which is to have some adult presence in the child's play life.
Since you mentioned that, Brent writes, when I was young in the 40s and 50s, as far as I know, I played outside unsupervised and had many an adventure. One time when I was maybe about 10, I went up into the woods above our neighborhood and set a small fire, watched it as it grew larger, then walked away from it. Some hours later, I heard the fire sirens and walked to the edge of the woods where the fire I had set was being fought not far from houses. At least I assumed it was the one I had set. Yeah, so it's good to have the play workers with the buckets. Yeah,
yeah. So, Mindy, I want to talk for a second. You alluded to, can we design playgrounds that are encouraging risk? And I think that that is absolutely true, and that I certainly agree with Joan that natural surroundings and adventure playgrounds are fantastic. But I also think that there's a design element that allows for the possibility of risk-taking. And this is where I want to encourage architects and landscape architects to sort of come back in. They've been absent for too long. And again, in Europe, there are very exciting things happening. But I want to just give one anecdote of something that I saw locally that is both design and nature, where a big sand pit is just surrounded by large natural boulders. And it's like, well, it's lovely to look at and very inexpensive to build and maintain. And then I was there once when a two-year-old came toddling up with a pail and shovel, one in each hand. And this happened so fast, it was almost breathtaking. She kind of looked around. She looked at these boulders that are bigger than she was. And it was clear within a second she had made an assessment that she couldn't have these things in her hand and get over the boulders. So she threw them over the boulders into the sand pit, and then she climbed on the boulders and lowered herself in. And I thought, that's amazing. Yeah. Here, a two-year-old is making an assessment, deciding that there's a risk, and figuring out how to overcome it.
Yeah, that's great. Skip is calling from West Barnstable. Hi, Skip.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
It's very fascinating, all of this. And I wanted to say, I came of age in the 50s, and we had our own adventure playgrounds. They were called junkyards. We used to sneak into them, and And there was also the risk assessment that we weren't supposed to be in these places.
Right.
So we would sneak in and we'd climb around and all this stuff, and you'd climb up on something, and there was always the risk that things would collapse on you, and we'd crawl into the cars and find old springs and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
And it was actually quite magical for all of us.
Yeah. Skip, I had a similar, when I was a kid, I lived, there was a dirt road in the woods and a lot of people would junk cars in there, and we used to play in the junked cars. And I can remember we would, you know, somebody would be the taxi driver and all the broken glass, we'd pick it up and say, here's the diamonds, take me to California. And, you know, think about, you would never let it, you know, would you let your kids play with broken glass in a junk car now? Yeah. Skip, thanks for the call. Has anyone kept track of injury rates in adventure playgrounds? Do we know how they compare to more traditional playgrounds?
We took a look at that when we did our report and interviewed directors of adventure playgrounds and looked at some studies from Canada and Europe as well. And as far as we can tell, the accident rates are absolutely not higher than in a traditional playground. And most people think they're lower, but the data is just not strong enough to be able to say that. What we do know is that insurance companies don't charge more for insuring parks departments with adventure playgrounds in this country. And there are several, one full-time in Berkeley, but several summer programs. And the parks directors would say, well, you know, if you have a swimming pool, basically you have enough insurance to cover an adventure playground. The risks are not considered any greater. And the three adventure playgrounds in California that we interviewed, of the three, all of them are over 30 years old. Two of them had one lawsuit each over 30 years, and the third one never had any lawsuit. So, you know, they're not considered dangerous places for children, actually.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the presence of play workers and the capability of children to risk assess and to play really well in situations like that. Children are very capable. They are not stupid. And they figure things out incredibly well on their own, as your callers have indicated.
Yeah. When we let them, yeah.
Yes, exactly, if we let them. And often the best thing to do is just stand back and observe, and you'll be amazed at how capable your children are.
Yeah. We only have like about a minute and a half left, but I wanted to mention unsupervised play. That's also important.
It is. And the play workers say, you know, they're present, but they put on their cape of invisibility so that they're not intruding in children's play. But even better is the movement to leave your children in the park alone, you know, with other children and so on. I don't know if that movement will really take off in this country because there's so much fear. But children benefit, and we're not talking about young children now, but elementary age children benefit enormously from being with their peers and having to negotiate and work through things without adult interference.
Yeah, I want to read just something from that article again from The Atlantic. It's hard to absorb how much childhood norms have shifted in just one generation. Actions that would have been considered paranoid in the 70s, walking third graders to school, forbidding your kid to play ball in the street, going down the slide with your child in your lap, are now routine. It's amazing how much things have changed in such a short time.
Yeah.
Just about 20
to change back again.
Yeah.
There are new adventure playgrounds being developed, especially summer programs around the country.
Yeah.
So there's hope.
Susan Solomon, architectural historian, and Joan Allman, founding director of the Alliance for Childhood. Thanks so much for being with us. Very fascinating topic this morning. Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.